I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Generally speaking, women in the United States are drinking more than their mothers and grandmothers did. They played a central role in the popularity of the California wine industry that targeted their ads to women. But while an occasional glass of Chardonnay is not a problem, women are entering alcohol treatment centers at a higher rate. Even the number of women charged with drunk driving has increased. Our guest, Gabrielle Glazer, noticed these changes in her own life and in the lives of her female friends and neighbors and decided to explore what was going on. The result is her new book. It's called Her Best Kept Secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. She joined us from the NPR studios in New York. And Gabrielle Glazer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me begin with you and the fact you write about this in your book, that you went through a stressful period in your life and you found yourself drinking more. What was the cause of that, do you think?
Oh, for heaven's sake. I was moving across the country from Portland, Oregon, where I have deep roots. My family is from Oregon. I left a job there that I liked. I loved the state. It's my home state. And I was moving back to the New York area. I had three teenagers. I was saying goodbye to my parents, goodbye to my sister. I didn't have three teenagers. I had two teenagers at the time. They weren't talking to me. My husband was commuting from New York and back to Oregon. My parents-in-law had moved to be near us. My mother-in-law was dying. And I was trying to sell a house and buy a new one. So my heart pretty much felt like a car alarm. And I found myself looking forward to my glass of wine a lot more frequently than usual and with a lot more urgency than usual. And it didn't take me very long to realize, oh, my gosh, I am drinking that wine. Nobody's putting those bottles in the recycling bin but me.
In fact, it wasn't just a glass of wine. It was several glasses of wine. As you say, something like 2/3 of a bottle of wine. You realize you were drinking that much pretty much every night.
I was, and that's about 3 glasses of wine. There are about 4.5 glasses of wine in a bottle. And so I was very aware that I was drinking that much. And I really, frankly, recognized relatively quickly that I was seeking this and I wanted this relaxation, but that it wasn't helping. However, I could also see how easily you could get into this bad habit.
You say relaxation. I mean, were you, as you look back at your life, were you drunk at the time or just these glasses of wine just sort of de-stressed you through this difficult period?
They de-stressed me through this difficult period. I wouldn't say I was drunk. I actually don't like the sensation of being drunk. I don't like to be out of control. But that third glass was taking me further and further away from a place of stability and functionality. And I actually really needed to be functional at night. Typically, I have a glass of wine at about 7:30. And because I had quit my job, I was drinking at 5 o'clock. And I realized that over a 2.5 hour period, I had had 3 glasses of wine. Technically, that's not, I've looked into this. Technically, that's not even binge drinking, but it sure felt like a lot to me. And it was too much for me to feel comfortable and be able to do what I needed to do later that evening.
Was this a secret? I mean, using the title of your book, were you drinking in a sense on the sly or sort of not telling people or letting people see how much you were drinking at this time?
Oh, it was out in the open because I was, I was in my kitchen. I was trying to cook. I was, the wine bottle was there and it was definitely not a secret. But I also realized that when I would put my recycling bin out on the street, the 3 bottles, 4 bottles that were there had been put there only by me that week. And it did make me feel kind of ashamed. I didn't want my mom to see that those bottles, she knew I was alone. She knew nobody else was drinking. And it what dawned on me about the secret was I noticed how many other people around me were secretive about their drinking. Actually, I had a neighbor who would put 2 giant bottles of Merlot, empty bottles, in my recycling bin every week when I lived in Portland, Oregon. And I thought it was just, oh, well, she just forgot to put them in her bin. But then I realized it happened every single week. And she was doing it probably because she was embarrassed to put them in her own bin.
Do you think the embarrassment is unique to women when it comes to overdrinking?
I don't think it's unique to women when they're over drinking, but I do believe that the stigma against women who drink too much, and particularly mothers who drink too much, is very much in place, and therefore women feel more ashamed. They're more aware of how people are going to judge them, and that's how we came up with the title of the book.
Well, what's interesting, and you do talk a bit about the history of drinking and prohibition in this country, and it should be said that, I guess it was the 19th century, there was a lot of almost like everyday drinking, I guess in many ways, because the water was potentially unsafe, and people turned to drink, thinking that it would be safer than water.
Absolutely, because people dumped their sewage in the same waterways from which they drew their drinking water. So alcohol was really the only safe thing to drink. It has antimicrobial properties, and it was both consumed for hydration and for calories. And even babies drank what was called small beer throughout the 18th and 19th, or mid-19th century.
Well, and the temperance movement, as we know, was many ways female led. The idea that the husbands would drink their income away and come home and potentially beat up on the family.
You know, actually, that turns out to be something of a misnomer. Certainly, that did happen, but the temperance movement had a way of promoting its cause, and they exaggerated those claims. Hmm. To their own ends. Certainly, I don't want to underestimate that you know, many women did suffer under their husband's drinking, but if you think about it, it's really, you know, people drink a lot today. Does that mean necessarily that they immediately have domestic disputes or domestic violence takes place? So many of those claims were kind of something that went viral, but it wasn't necessarily true.
But the idea that, I guess, associating drinking with sinful behavior, that was part of the message?
That was absolutely part of the message. As the Great Revival, the Protestant movement that spread through the country in the mid-19th century, developed steam, one of the things that women attached to in particular was abolishing alcohol, certainly abolishing slavery, and educating women. And if they could, you know, accomplish those three goals, it was the world was going to be a safer place for the second coming of Christ. That's what they believed. So,
linking a number of powerful ideas together. So, when do you think women, and we're speaking broadly here, obviously, women started to drink more?
Well, you know, the statistics on that are really something a little bit perplexing, because though the government has tracked how people drink and what people drink for some time, researchers really didn't start looking into the numbers of what women were drinking and how they were drinking until the 1970s. Right. We know from Gallup polls in the 1950s that certainly men and women both drank, but those polls weren't gender specific until about the 1970s. And in fact, a Harvard researcher who was researching alcohol's effects on humans realized that there were no women in any of the studies. Her name is Sharon Wilsnack, and she was told to go to the Widener Library at Harvard. And out of tens of thousands of studies, she dug up only six that had even the notations of female rats. So that was really quite an enormous oversight.
What does that tell you or tell us?
Well, it tells us certainly that throughout the 20th century, women were treated, you know, if it was good for the goose, it was good for the gander. And women were kind of just lumped into many medical research studies, in the same way that men were. We found that in heart studies. I think that came out in the 1990s. And certainly in the alcohol studies, women were just completely overlooked.
You know what I found interesting in your book, and we, you know, now we know about Napa, Sonoma, all the California wines and the wine industry that's grown up there. But you really say that their campaign of marketing was to target women. And why did they think that women would be a good market for wine?
Well, one reason is that women weren't buying wine. Male, the wine industry, the wine, you know, the consumption of wine was a completely male domain. At a restaurant, I think you can, you know, many listeners will be able to remember back to the time when a man was handed the wine list. He was handed the first taste. He was handed the cork. It was a very, very, very male-dominated culture and ritual. And the winemakers wanted people to consume their beverages. And I really, I don't mean to make the wine industry out to be the bad guys here, because I think wine in moderation is a terrific thing. But in order to kind of get their the wineries back up after Prohibition, they knew they needed to target Americans of all stripes, but especially women, because women held the purse strings for the family budget. Women were the ones doing the buying for all the domestic purchases, and if women could get to taste wine, maybe they would begin enjoying it. And, you know, they, several decades later, women have really started enjoying it.
Well, in fact, you even talk about, I guess it was McCall's magazine, touting wine as the, quote, anti-stress diet.
Yeah. In 1977, they ran a piece that said, you know, here's part of your anti-stress diet, and it helps with digestion, and it certainly helps take the edge off. And, you know, there's no question, obviously, that wine is that alcohol in general is an antidote for anxiety. But when people start drinking too much, that's what, you know, that's where we get into problems.
But it is interesting to look at that trend and then to see more women going to work, more women and men included, but since we're talking about women, trying to balance work and the home place, and they've got their parents that they're concerned about, that a lot of women are under a lot of stress these days.
Oh, they certainly are. I mean, you open even a wellness magazine, and it will tell you how to cope with your aging parents, how to cope with sending your kids off to college, how to maintain your footing in your workplace, even when you're, you know, starting to age and starting to feel as if you need to keep some sort of, a younger profile. And you can always ask your doctor about Juvederm. You can ask your doctor about Radius. I mean, the pressure is real. And I think a lot of women feel it. It's just kind of a struggle to get through the day without losing your mind.
We're almost up on a break here, but do you think you are typical in that you just saw your drinking sort of sneaking up on you at a stressful period? Do you think your story is a story that a lot of women could tell?
Oh, I think it absolutely is. I definitely think so.
And just that you find yourself in a difficult situation, and there's the glass of wine, and you're making dinner.
Exactly. And it's one thing, you know, it's perfectly fine to have that glass of wine while you're making dinner, and then even another small one while you're having dinner. And what the research shows is that when women frequently start to consume more than two, between two and three is where the mortality rates start to dip, where problems start to show up. And in the government, I mean, the government tells us that we should really stick to one.
Well, we're going to take a very short break. I'm sorry about that, to get back to our conversation. Sorry, Gabrielle. We'll be right back after this short break. And our guest is Gabrielle Glaser, talking about her new book. It's titled Her Best Kept Secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. Much more after this short break. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
When Johnny Marr first heard the Smiths' classic, How Soon Is Now, the experience was, for him, like for us, magic.
I remember waking up, and it was dark, and I had this cassette by the side of my bed, and I was like, what happened last night? I think I did something really amazing.
Guitar hero Johnny Marr joins us this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Kirkpatrick, New York Times Cairo bureau chief. He arrived in the region just before the start of the Arab Spring, covered the Egyptian Revolution, and now he's been reporting on the military's ouster of Egypt's first democratically elected president. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, a Chinese company won the contract to build a $40 billion canal in Nicaragua, but there's skepticism it will actually happen.
There are a lot of barriers in terms of the environmental issues, political issues. I don't plan on floating down the Nicaragua Canal anytime soon, but who am I to say that it can't happen?
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking about the fact that more women are drinking more, especially wine. Let me play a series of scenes from the show Cougar Town. It stars Courtney Cox. Let's listen.
Who wants wine?
You know we drink lots of red wine.
Yeah, and?
That's it.
For you ladies, I assume two giant buckets of wine?
Red, please. Half red, half white.
Oh, you need more Chardonnay, and better Chardonnay.
I was going out to get wine. And we could come back and drink that $28 bottle of wine that you bought.
Can you believe that I spend as much money on wine as I do food?
White wine has less alcohol.
Ooh, thinking wine.
They say you can get 4 glasses of wine out of one bottle. I only get like 1.5.
Where's my wine?
All the glasses are in the dishwasher.
Right, well, use that squeezy bottle that I take to spin class.
We took that off of a YouTube video of a series of scenes from this the show Cougar Town, and we're talking with Gabrielle Glazer. Her book is called Her Best Kept Secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I'm not sure, Gabrielle, hearing that, whether I want to have a glass of wine or not. It's sort of, you know, when it's all sort of edited together, it seems kind of disgusting.
Yeah, actually, I'm surprised. That's a lot of wine talk. I know
it
that
is a
show,
lot of wine talk.
I know that show makes a joke out of it, and I kind of, you know, started looking at that for research purposes. But when you splice that all together, that's a lot.
One of the things you say at the very end of your book, sort of answering the question why more women are drinking more, and you basically say because they can.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, because it's there. First of all, it's available, it's legal, it's socially acceptable, and nobody's going to stop them. And I'm not sure anybody should stop them. I don't want to make this an anti-drinking book, but I do want people to know that it's important to be mindful of what we're doing and how we're relaxing or how we think we're relaxing. I know certainly that when I was in that period of high stress and drinking that amount of wine, I wasn't feeling more relaxed. I may have felt slightly less nervous, but it didn't make me feel more relaxed, and there's a difference. And I think it's important that we, you know, you just keep a mental tally of where you're going and what you're doing and why you think you need it.
You don't like the word alcoholic.
No, I try to avoid it. In science today, researchers use the term for the condition of being dependent on alcohol. Mm. They use the term alcohol use disorder. The term alcoholic was, I'm not exactly sure of the origins. I think it comes from the 19th century, but it certainly developed more currency in the 1940s and 50s with Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, researchers like to note that there is a spectrum of alcohol abuse. You can be mildly dependent. You can be using it mildly in a way that's unhealthy. You can be moderately using it in a way that's unhealthy. Or you can be severely using it in a way that's unhealthy. Mm-hmm. And so the term alcohol use disorder has certainly supplanted alcoholic, which kind of means it's kind of like it kind of means one thing. And that means somebody who's, you know, really, really, really dependent and needs a drink first thing in the morning, or needs to you know, has the DTs if they're in withdrawal, and it's kind of old fashioned.
Mm. I mean, it sounds old fashioned as you describe it, and obviously there's been an attempt to try to update it and understand it in a deeper kind of way. You do look at the sort of physiological effects of drinking on women. Obviously, people that overdrink, it affects them in very negative ways. Do you think there's something unique about this physiological reaction?
Yes. Women have more body fat than men and less water than men. And fat absorbs alcohol and water dilutes it. So a 150-pound woman who's drinking the same as a 150-pound man is going to have become intoxicated typically earlier, and she's also going to suffer toxic effects of alcohol earlier in a telescoped fashion. Women also make less of an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase, which helps process alcohol. So again, the toxic effects of alcohol are going to show up earlier in her body than they will in a man who drinks exactly the same amount.
So she's at greater risk for problem drinking?
She's at greater risk for problem drinking. She's at greater risk for liver damage. She's at greater risk for skin damage. She's at greater risk for all sorts of organ damage that can come with prolonged, heavy, excessive drinking.
You have some criticisms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I do want to talk about that. It's obviously something that grew up a number of decades ago, generations ago, the idea of a self-help group to deal with the problems of problem drinking. What is your main problem with Alcoholics Anonymous?
Well, when I started doing research for this book, I noticed that it was a one-size-fits-all problem for a lot of different people who may not have had the same issue that the men who in 1935 developed the 12 steps suffered themselves. And the more I researched, the more I looked into the science, the more I interviewed people and experts, people who'd been in AA, people who had left AA, people who were researching other options, the more I realized that it was an out, it can be an outdated method of recovery for a lot of women. It was developed, as you say, in 1935 for men, middle-class white men, who were very privileged in society. And the steps require people to acknowledge their powerlessness. They surrender their egos to a higher power, to a god of their understanding. And it also asks women or people to scrutinize their flaws. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's you know, I thought was that women typically are very aware of their flaws already, and they may not be feeling that powerful in society to begin with. And there are many, many other options for women available, and that's what I started to look into. I also found that...
Finish your thought. Go ahead.
I also found that, you know, many women actually can be hurt in AA. There are a number of people who are not there for women's best interests, and they need to know about that.
Let me pick up on all of that. And actually, I have something you probably read in The Atlantic. This was written by Amy Gutman, and the headline says, "No, Alcoholics Anonymous is not ill-suited to women." And she talks about her own drinking problems and the fact that she has walked into an AA meeting in New York. It was all women there and was extremely helped by AA, and apparently has been helped over the years by her meetings and her associations with Alcoholics Anonymous. So anecdotally, at least, for some women, AA seems to work very, very well.
Well, that's true. And certainly for people like Gutman and for whom it works, that's fantastic. But their experiences are different. I got that reaction from many people. Hey, it worked for me. It worked for my mom. Therefore, it works. And you shouldn't question the efficacy of it because it's going to risk somebody else's life. But what's interesting is that I'm really not telling anybody who likes AA to leave it. I'm suggesting that there are vast number of women out there who are somewhere on the alcohol use disorder spectrum, and they have trouble with AA. There are other options. And furthermore, the science regarding AA, in as much as it can be studied scientifically, it's difficult to study it scientifically because you can't put people into a randomly controlled trial. People know they're in AA. Right. But one study that I found in 2000, published in the Alcoholism Treatment Quarterly, found that of 100 people who attend on January 1st, only 5 will still be attending on December 31st. Now, that comes from AA's own figures. That's the data. I didn't report that to be insulting to anybody, but certainly it's you know, been taken that way, and I understand that. But again, if your experiences in it are you know, positive, that's great. That's, you know, then this book isn't for you.
Mm. Picking up on the powerlessness part of Alcoholics Anonymous, the idea that people have to acknowledge the fact that they are often in a state of powerlessness against the temptation of drinking, if I can use that language. But do you think that applies uniquely to women, or do you think that for men as well, that perhaps even growing up in difficult households, they felt powerless in a household where maybe there was an abusive parent?
Exactly. And what researchers say and what research shows is that people feel much better when they're empowered to make healthy changes in their lives, whether it's abstaining or moderating. Mm-hmm. And AA requires people to abstain from alcohol essentially for the rest of their lives. Not essentially, for the rest of their lives. And the research shows us that overwhelmingly, the number of people who are problem drinkers do not need to abstain for the rest of their lives. There's great success in programs in which moderation is a key component. Certainly in Europe, in Asia, in Hong Kong, in Australia, those are the methods of choice. Teaching people to learn to moderate.
That's Gabrielle Glaser, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about her new book. It's called Her Best Kept Secret, and it's subtitled Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. She's a journalist who has written for a number of publications, including The New York Times, The Economist, Glamour, The Washington Post, Health, and she's also the author of two other books, Strangers to the Tribe and The Nose. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You also write, and you just said a couple of minutes ago, that women can be at risk attending some of these AA meetings. Give us an example.
Well, there's something in AA called the 13th step, and that is an unwanted sexual come on of an old timer toward a newcomer. And It's something that's been ongoing and systemic since the early days of AA. There's evidence to support that. And certainly it is something that is, you know, quite systemic now. A trustee in AA itself wrote a 7-page memo, which was given to me, detailing instances of sexual abuse that he personally knew of and was anguished by. And the general board of Alcoholics Anonymous wrote back 2 years later to say that they understood that it was a problem and that it was, you know, certainly distressing, but that they couldn't do anything about it because the system of AA itself lacks a hierarchy. It's kind of it's not like a franchise. You adopt the literature, you can have a meeting anywhere, and there's really no head. There's no controlling body. So, but there is also, I also found an addictions journal that found that 58% of women who attend AA have received some sort of sexual harassment or unwanted come on by another member, and 4% of them had been raped. And a lot of women say, you know, many of the critics say, but that never happened to me. I didn't see that. That's unfair. And you're going to scare people. But those are the facts. And certainly, I've spoken to many women to whom that happened. I profiled a woman who has led a crusade in AA itself. She was a member for 36 years. Her name is Monica Richardson. And she tried desperately hard to institute some changes herself, and documented many, many, many cases of sexual abuse.
But do you think this is common? And by that, I mean it happens frequently or commonly at groups that are held across the country? Or do you think there are sort of unique groups, for whatever reason, have what sounds like predators within these groups?
I think it's important to remember that 1 out of every 10 people in AA are there by court order. Many of those are from DUIs, you know, driving under the influence, but many others are there because they are on parole, they were sex offenders, they were domestic violence, they were, you know, domestic abusers, and as a way of lessening their sentences, they are often referred to AA. They're mandated by the courts to attend. And it doesn't mean that they've gotten their other problems under control. And they often find vulnerable women who are on shaky ground, or vulnerable men for that matter, who are on shaky ground. They're new in their sobriety. And I spoke to a lot of people who said, you know what? Hey, they're easy targets. Mm-hmm. I found a diary of a sex offender in Montana who said that he specifically targeted young women who were early in their sobriety for his sexual gratification.
But does that raise questions about these groups that are, in a sense, self-run, and whether they have the kind of capacity to deal with people like this in their midst?
Yes, it certainly does. And what's interesting is that AA in Australia and AA in Great Britain instituted safety guidelines and behavioral guidelines that so far AA in the United States has mm-hmm. you know, not even considered. And furthermore, many people say, yes, but you should go to a woman's meeting. You should go to a women's meeting if you're by yourself and you're trying to get sober. It's mm-hmm. really more important to go to a women's meeting. But there really aren't that many women's meetings. I did a search of several large cities, and I found that about 6% of all meetings issued in large cities, I believe I used Atlanta, Washington, D.C., Seattle, maybe a couple of others. So that's, if you really need to go to a meeting mm-hmm. and this is helping you and AA is your place of choice, it's very difficult to find a women's only meeting.
But are you, I mean, I have to say the part of this book where you were detailing some of these women who had been targeted, are you trying to scare people away from going, or women from going to an AA meeting?
No, I'm not. Well, actually, I'm trying to raise awareness about women going to AA meetings. And what I wanted to do and what I've tried to do is suggest that there are many, many, many other options. And there are. And we just don't know about those. Certainly, there's a group called Smart Recovery that uses evidence-based practice. So they rely on science to try to help people regain their sobriety. There is a harm reduction group called HAMS. There are groups for moderating, including there's something called Moderation Management, which is, and you can find that on the internet, called moderation.org. And most importantly, the U.S. government itself has found that there is a medication called naltrexone. It's generic. It's available relatively cheaply. Big Pharma is not making a ton of money on this. In conjunction with medical management, so that is this drug, naltrexone, used, prescribed by a doctor and used correctly, can help mm-hmm. really curb cravings and help women and men regain either moderation or abstain, you know, depending on what it is they're trying to achieve. That is the most effective way to treat alcohol abuse in the world. And very few people know about it. And we spent $30 million to find that out. And somehow, and that study came out in 2006, and somehow that message just hasn't gotten out there.
Well, I want to pick up on that, but first a very short break, and we have a lot of callers that want to join our conversation. Again, Gabrielle Glazer, our guest today on Radio Times. Her new book is called Her Best Kept Secret, and it's subtitled Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. We're going to take a very short break, and as I said, get back to our conversation. And it looks like the lines have exploded at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Wells Fargo, working with the Women's Business Development Center of Greater Philadelphia to help provide resources to entrepreneurs throughout the region. Details on Wells Fargo's work in the small business community at wellsfargo.com/commitment. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A lot of dads dream of watching even one of their kids make it to the NFL, but Gertie Gronkowski saw three of his sons get there, including New England Patriots superstar Rob Gronkowski. Gertie and the boys talk about how they did it in the new memoir, Growing Up Gronk. Gertie joins us next time on Tell Me More.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Most parents hate to think about their teens and young adult children using and misusing alcohol. Experimentation is common, but it comes with risks to health and safety at an important time of physical and emotional development. On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, the birds and the bees of young adult drinking, what parents and their children need to know and talk about. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
Wheaton Arts in Millville, New Jersey supports WHYY and announces Wheaton Wide Open, featuring daily glassmaking demonstrations and family art activities. No admission tickets required during July. Presented by PNC Arts Alive. Details at wheatonarts.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, Gabrielle Glazer is our guest. We've been talking about the fact that she went through a period in her life when she realized she was drinking too much, and she also realized she was not alone. She's done some research into the phenomenon to try to find out why more women are drinking more, how it affects them physically and psychologically, and what treatments have shown promise. And again, she's the author of a book called Her Best Kept Secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. And I do want to get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. But I do want to pick up on something you said right before the break. We were talking about Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a self-help group that is free, doesn't cost anybody anything, and you were talking about some of the treatments that have been showing some promise. But those treatments, if we're talking about medication, that costs money. Going to a doctor, that costs money. I mean, in certain ways, it feels like an apples and oranges argument here.
Well, under Obamacare, that will be, and the Mental Health Parity Act, that will change. Those other options that I mentioned, those are free. SMART, certainly moderation.org. There's a group called SOS. There's a group called Women for Sobriety. All those groups are self-help groups, and they are they're free.
But the treatments, as you talked about, naltrexone showing some promise, and you do describe some medical people in your book who do provide what looks like, again, promising treatment, but again, that requires having insurance and being able to afford these services.
Right. Certainly, medication costs money, but medication for diabetes costs money, medication for asthma costs money, and naltrexone is a drug that I believe can be, in the generic form, costs less than $100 a month. So, I understand that it's apples and oranges, but I think that if it's important to a person to try to get a hold of this problem, this is the most effective way. And if you don't have insurance, that will change in the future under Obamacare. So moving forward, I think that's certainly something that we need to broaden the conversation to include other options and other ways of getting better.
Let me see what looks like Jean from Conshohocken has to say. Jean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm calling. Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Jean.
I'm calling because I have had a partner who was alcoholic. And I chose to go to Al-Anon for my own needs. And I found that it was extremely hostile to women who hadn't, quote, chosen to stay with their alcoholic. And I left.
And Jean, how long ago was this?
About 10 years.
And did you go to another group, or are you just...
I tried it several times, and it was kind of that, your alcoholic is no longer part of your life, so that's... you're here for the wrong reason or something those lines.
Well, let me see what our guest, Gabrielle Glazer, has to say. Did you look at Al-Anon?
I did a little bit. And Al-Anon grew up, again, also in the 1940s, and it was created by the wife of the founder of AA. Her name was... Lois. Her name was Lois. Jean was the caller. And it was really, Jean, I'm not surprised that you had that experience, because it was a system that was a kind of a bookend to the beliefs of Alcoholics Anonymous itself. And again, if this works for somebody, that's fantastic. But many women have been in your position. They didn't perhaps have the, they weren't, they didn't feel, they don't feel comfortable there. And if the, if you question the beliefs, there sometimes is the notion that there might be something wrong with you. Certainly that's what I heard from many, many of my sources.
Jean, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I feel the need to say, I'm sure there are people who also have been helped by Al-Anon, just to make sure that, that our listeners understand what we're talking about today on Radio Times. Let me see what Barbara Ann has to say, calling us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Barbara Ann, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And Gabrielle, thank you. I love your show, and I really get this topic. My mother was an alcoholic. She died at a very young age.
I'm sorry.
And I have a brother that struggles with the disease, and my daughter's bipolar, and she struggles with it. But she's getting treatment today, and as of today, she's okay. But I just want to mention, and for my experience, I think mental illness is the underlying problem, because I think my mother was bipolar and was never diagnosed. She had a very privileged life, and, you know, she did have some stress, but, I mean, she was active all the way to the end, and she never did find recovery. Consequently, you know, I attend Al-Anon meetings, and I just also want to make a comment of that, too. Yes, there are predators in both groups. I've been going to Al-Anon for 20 years, and when I started Al-Anon 20-some-odd years ago, you know, there weren't that many men, but there are more men today. And, yeah, I have experienced that as well in Al-Anon.
Well, I'm sorry.
It's a problem in both programs.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Gabrielle.
Barbara Ann, thank you for that call. It's important to point out one thing that we hadn't mentioned is that you're absolutely right. Women are twice as likely as men to be diagnosed with anxiety and depression and to self-medicate those conditions with alcohol. They're also more likely to have had sexual abuse as young women or children, and they're also more likely to have had eating disorders. Those are also risk factors. And when AA was developed in the 1930s, our knowledge of neurology and brain chemistry was really in its infancy. So, you know, again, I want to say that if it does work for you, that's fantastic. But we do know more about some of the underlying causes of what makes people drink, what makes people vulnerable to drinking too much, and then what treatment they will respond best to in the event that it gets out of hand.
Barbara Ann, thanks for the call to Radio Times. As you mentioned earlier, it's really hard to do research on something like Alcoholics Anonymous. It's decentralized. You know, it's self-help, meaning that the people choose to go there. And I would think it would be hard to do any kind of research on probably most aspects of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yes, you're exactly right. And furthermore, it's anonymous. So
exactly.
The characteristics of the group lead, you know, do not lend itself to scientific research, of course. So but what we do know, certainly, I mean, there one large report in 2006 called the Cochrane Library. They did a meta-analysis of different treatments from around the globe and found that Alcoholics Anonymous really was among the 12-step groups were among the least effective ways to get better.
You mentioned some of these other groups. Are they more effective? Has anyone looked at their success rate or failure rate?
What people have looked at is what actually works. There's something called motivational interviewing that allows people to decide for themselves why they want to get better, what it is that they want to change about their lives. And these groups all use aspects of motivational interviewing. They use aspects of cognitive behavioral therapy. It's a mix of things. Just as alcohol use itself is really on a spectrum, it's a mosaic, so too are many of these other programs. And they require a lot more of the person's personal input than do the 12 steps of AA.
I would think, though, for someone who has, and maybe even some of the women that you describe in this book, who using your title, Her Best Kept Secret, the idea of sharing a secret with other people who have probably done some version of what you have done has got to make you feel like you're not so alone.
Absolutely. And I think that is where all of these self-help groups draw a lot of their strength, is that people feel that they're not alone, and they feel that, okay, these people have done this ahead of me, they've gotten better ahead of me, I can do it too. And it certainly, you know, that's certainly what propels a lot of people, is to have a guide or someone who's been in your steps, in the same, I don't mean the steps, the 12 steps, but right, someone who's been in your position before. That's very helpful in all of these groups. And they're all peer-led, or many of them are peer-led. I know HAMS is peer-led, SOS is peer-led, SMART definitely has some peer-led aspects to it. But yes, I think it's important, if you feel ashamed, to be able to share with people, you know, what it is that you're ashamed of.
And to feel accepted
once
you have done that sharing. Let me see what Lee from Northeast Philadelphia has to say. Lee, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
I love this conversation. I was thinking about this before I even turned on the radio today.
Really?
I was listening to what you were saying earlier, and that reminds me of me. I mean, I will drink 2 glasses of wine when I got home. And part of it was a sleeping problem. And with my job, I'm not allowed to take any type of sleeping pills that they'd show up in a drug test. And for a couple of years, it started to escalate. And now I'm starting to cut back, but I'm having difficulty, again, with the sleep problems and with stress. And I got it down to about 4 days a week, but I still would like to do more. And the one thing I wanted to mention is with health care, I have health care, but a lot of healthcare plans don't provide is any type of counseling. If I want to go see a therapist, it's going to be $50 an hour, and that's not an option. I can't afford that. I looked into AA, and I kind of agree with you. I think that there's other options. The irregular sleeping habits, I think, are one of the worst problems with me, and my hours constantly change at my job.
Well, you
so
know,
I'm kind of like,
yeah, no, that's okay. Let me, first of all, I appreciate you calling into Radio Times, and it's good that you're thinking about this and trying to do something about it. And I think Gabrielle, she's described how difficult it is to find something for an individual, to find something that's going to work for them.
I would urge you, Lee, to look at Women for Sobriety, and certainly, again, SMART online. Women for Sobriety was developed in Quakertown,
yes,
Pennsylvania?
Quakertown, yep.
Yeah, Quakertown, Pennsylvania. And I know that one of the largest group memberships, it does happen to be in Pennsylvania. So, Lee, I would look there. I would also, one thing that many of the researchers have told me, that when they deal with patients who are trying to cut down, is to just change your schedule a little bit, if you can do that. If your typical solution is that you're going to come home and open that refrigerator and uncork the wine and pour yourself a big glass, if you do that typically when you come home, it's just a craving. And if you can try to change your schedule, go for a walk, do something different. If you can, you know, exercise, if it's at all possible, you know, if you've got kids at home, I know that's really hard, but if there's something you can do to make yourself relax, there are also some meditation tapes that have been very, very helpful for many people. I'm sorry, I don't have that on the top of my head right now, but I can certainly provide it for you later. There are meditation tapes that, if you can listen to them in the car or on your iPod on the way home, you can just be in a little bit better frame of mind to get yourself geared up for the evening. And the sleep, I agree with you. I'm in that position of life myself. I'm 49 years old, and I probably shouldn't be dispensing medical advice, but when I can't
Please
sleep,
don't.
I take a Benadryl. Okay, all right.
Hey,
I take a Benadryl.
Don't do that.
Okay, sorry.
It's okay, but Lee, thanks
It's allergy medication.
I understand, yes, allergy, in quotations. Lee, thanks for the call to Radio Times. How much drinking do you do now, Gabrielle?
I I drink about a glass of wine, sometimes two, for about four nights a week, for sometimes five nights a week. And that is what certainly the U.S. guidelines suggest. One glass a day is mm-hmm. has health benefits. And mine is probably a little over that. France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, Australia, South Africa. These are all countries in which, not South Africa, but these are all countries in which women live much longer than American women. The recommendations for healthy drinking are at least double, sometimes triple, of what the U.S. Recommends. That's also something that perplexed me, and I wanted to look into that.
Well, in fact, you spent some time in France and enjoyed that French style of living.
Absolutely. And what's different about French drinking is that it's typically not done in isolation. It's not how American women drink. American women come home, and I speak from experience here, mm-hmm. and drink alone. And they drink by the typical pattern is that you come home, you start drinking, and you mm-hmm. you keep going. And certainly I spoke to many, many women who, you know, I had one woman who drank two bottles of wine, another woman who drank 2 liters of wine a night. And that's not a very French or Italian or Spanish way of drinking. Their meals are combined with alcohol, or alcohol is a part of a healthy meal. And people typically don't overdrink in those societies.
Well, we are out of time. And my thanks to you, Gabrielle Glaser, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. The book is called Her Best Kept Secret, and it's subtitled Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. She joined us from the NPR studios in New York. She's also the author of Strangers to the Tribe and The Nose, and she's a journalist whose work has appeared in a number of publications, including The New York Times and The Economist, The Washington Post, and Health. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Nick Sessler, our intern for today's edition of the show. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder with Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.